Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, activist and author Will Juwondo discusses his book, My Seven Black Fathers, a young activist's memoir of race, family, and the mentors who made him whole. He is joined by Ambassador Carolyn Curiel. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022 at the American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Good evening. Hello, everybody. My name is Sonal Shukla, and I am the Assistant Director of Programming and Education at the American Writers Museum. Welcome to the American Writers Festival and to this event. Our final program today is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's upcoming exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. Will Juwondo is an attorney, an activist, a community leader, and a council member in the Montgomery County, Maryland, a diverse community of more than 1 million residents. Called the progressive leader we need by the late Congressman John Lewis, Mr. Juwondo has worked with Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senator Sherrod Brown, and President Barack Obama. His writing has appeared in the Washington Post and The Root and on BET.com. And his work has been featured in the New York Times and New York Magazine and on NPR, NBC News, and MTV. He regularly appears on CNN, MSNBC, and other media outlets. His first book, My Seven Black Fathers, is a young activist's memoir of race, family, and the mentors who made him whole. He's here to discuss it with Ambassador Carolyn Curiel, a former U.S. ambassador to Belize and senior presidential speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. She also led elections endorsements team at the New York Times editorial board. She's also an AWM board member. Please join me in welcoming both of them on stage. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming and supporting the American Writers Museum, and also this event today with an exciting new member on the stage with me here, an exciting new entry into memoirs as a category among, I think, leaders current and future.
Thank you.
So Will Juwondo, as you just heard, is a council member in Montgomery County, which is north of Washington, D.C., and his memoir, his first, and we say first because I'm anticipating more after this, Will. His first memoir talks about not just his early years, but years that were crucial to his growth under the tutelage of seven men. The book is My Seven Black Fathers. Tell us what motivated you to write this book, and tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. Thanks for having me, and thanks to the festival. Congrats. This is the first one of these, right? So hopefully many more. And I want to just shout out my wife, Michelle, who's here and in the front. You know, this book is deeply personal. It was and it's also really affirming. I wrote it at a time when, as much of the world, we're all going through a lot, right? I wrote it during the pandemic. If you're African American, I'd like to, you know, unfortunately say there were three pandemics at least: the health, the economic fallout, and then the racial justice, you know, witnessing the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and others. And so I really needed to write this book to have, at this time, to talk about the power and, you know, one of the things I love about the book, and I'm biased, is the title, My Seven Black Fathers. I came up with that, and you know, being a writer, it's very rare that the author's title lives through the process, and it did. And I think it really encapsulates a couple of the core principles in the book. One, trying to expand the definition of fatherhood, right? And each of these, I'm from the planet Earth, I have one biological father, but all of these men had a tremendous impact on me and were fathers. And there's other people in the book, obviously, as well that we'll talk about. But also at a time where, you know, all of this has been happening and there's all these stereotypes and tropes, particularly about black men and boys. it's a love letter to that community too, in a very personal way, of in a testament to the power that we have within ourselves to, in the midst of this storm that is, that I described with the three pandemics and systemic and institutional racism and all the things that mass incarceration, go down the list, there's something we can do about it to help each other as we tackle those systems. And each of these men, in unique and indelible ways, fathered me. From Mr. Williams, my fourth grade math teacher, who was the only and first black male teacher I would ever have, taught me how to tie a tie, taught me how to deal with bullying, taught me math as well. He was the first first black man I'd ever seen wear a jacket and tie every day. Came in, he modeled for me and helped me in a deeply personal way. But I only knew him for 9 months. And all of these relationships are different. I didn't even know his first name until I researched for the book and found his grandkids and his children. And he passed away in 2019. And then you go to chapter 6, which is Barack Obama, who I meet in my mid-20s when I'm working on Capitol Hill, and who I get married to Michelle, and we have two of our four children while I'm working for him in the White House, and he really helps me in my growth and development as a husband and a father. And, you know, we'll talk about the other men, but each of them gave me unique things, and I hope that this will, you know, be an example of the power of these relationships.
So, for me, the power in the story is the journey. So to know how important each of those men were to you, you have to know how much building up you really needed, right? So tell us about those earliest days.
Yeah, I'll read maybe, you want to tell me when you want me to read, but I want to read some of the introduction for folks. So my dad was born in Nigeria, in colonial Nigeria, left the country on the tail end of the Civil War in that country and came to the United States on a scholarship, not an uncommon story, and found his way to Hayes, Kansas, right in the middle of Kansas, where my mom is, you know, a white woman from Kansas from a farm town, and they met in college. And they got together, much to the chagrin of everyone in that small town, and then they decided to move east to Maryland and D.C. area for opportunity economically, but also for more understanding of their interracial relationship. But it was a struggle. The relationship was on a rocky grounds, and by the time I'm 6, they're separated and they're divorced. And I describe my father as in the book as an absent presence. He was physically there for those first 6 years, but there was no connection, no relationship. I would try to talk to him. He would just sit on the couch and listen to stereos. And I would find out later he was very depressed. And so the void created by his absence necessitated these men, these fathers. And I was desperate for that attention. And we were, you know, very low income as well. So you had multiple things going on. You had an abusive relationship between my mother and father when they were together. You had no relationship for me and him. You had poverty, you had depression, and then you had absence. And so,
and there was the racism that he encountered every day.
Yes. You know, he had a very heavy accent coming from Nigeria.
Pronounce his name for us, you would.
Olayinka Ishola Jawando is his name. We actually named our youngest son after him. My dad passed away in 2017 of cancer. And I think one of the greatest things about this book, as we'll talk about, is the journey we had together to finally reconcile.
I think it's really powerful that the bookends for this book, if there can be a bookend for one book, is beginning with that relationship and coming to closure on the relationship in such a way that really feels deep, real, satisfying closure.
And I think it's something that doesn't happen. It's one of the universal themes in the book. You know, how many of us have issues with our fathers or mothers or, you know, or estranged? And I have no relationship with my dad early on. And in a way, that absence creates the needs for these men.
But tell us what was eating him up.
Yes. So you mentioned racism, right? Let's start there. He worked, he was an IT computer science major, and never really found his footing in a career. He bounced from temp job to temp job, never made a lot of money. I think he suffered from severe disappointment. You know, when you go to U.S. from a country like Nigeria, you're supposed to go there to make it. And I think his brother had gone to the U.S. 11 years prior and had made it. So he was the youngest of four children. And he didn't live up to, I think, that expectation he had of himself and familial expectation. And he was routinely, discriminated against at work, you know, made fun of. He felt that the relationship with my mother, he wasn't happy about that, and felt aggrieved, especially early on, that my mother and my stepfather, who you talk about bookends, he's the first chapter, Joseph Jacob, who's the printer at my mom's job, and Olayinka Jawando at the end, he felt aggrieved that his wife had been taken from him. So he was really dealing with a lot of deep disappointment. And the fact that he never learned how to be a father. His dad was had three wives concurrently. He grew up Muslim. My dad was the youngest of the first wife. And so by the time he was born, the wives two and three were already on the scene. Other children had been born. And he never learned those skills. So there was a lot going on with him that I didn't learn till much later.
But the result of this is that you don't understand all of this as a child.
Absolutely.
And your mother is trying to pick up the slack at home, but you have a real missing presence, which is this not a story of a huge portion of America? Yours being unique for the circumstances. So how do you start belonging, feeling that you can belong? You met a boy named Kalafani. Can you tell us about him?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'll read a little bit about him. But Kalafani is the coolest kid in fifth grade when I meet him, and I talk about him in the introduction. He's the best basketball player, most popular guy. He's a son of an immigrant like me. His mother's from Jamaica. And I meet him at a time at fifth grade when my parents have separated. I'm this chubby, biracial kid with rec specs and trying to fit in. Middle school's horrible for a lot of people, but it's especially bad for me. And Kalafani takes me under his wing.
He was respected by his peers.
Oh, absolutely. He set the teams up. We meet on the basketball court in fifth grade.
I'm thinking he was your first Barack Obama.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he is... You know, when I'm searching for, I'm yearning for attention, particularly black male attention, but I'm also yearning for an authentic black male experience because my dad's from Nigeria, my mom's white. I'm now at a school where the kids are mostly black and brown, and I don't know where I belong. And basketball, and Kalafani in particular, is an entry point into that. And I immerse myself in that, and we become best friends. Through much of elementary, middle school, and even into high school, until he unfortunately loses his life in an act of gun violence. And it's not an uncommon story, unfortunately, but he wasn't the first or last person that I would lose to gun violence, but he was certainly the closest. And, you know, I talk about, he really could have been one of my black fathers as well, just because of the impact he had on me. So maybe I'll read a little bit about him.
I think that'd be terrific. Thank you.
As a 9-year-old, I remember first peering at Kalafani playing through a chain link fence. Brown skin, keen featured, and long limbed, Kalafani was a natural born leader. For weeks, I watched from afar as each boy made his way to the 3-point line and had his shot at becoming captain. Kalafani was usually the first to make a basket, with a perfectly formed jump shot that flew high in the air and more often than not hit the net only. Kalafani judiciously picked the teams, matching each player with a worthy competitor. He also called all the fouls and outs, and the other boys across grade levels looked to him for guidance. Watching my classmates gathered on the court to serve up braggadocious dreams and layups, I thought their goals of besting Reggie Miller's three-point percentage or getting drafted to the NBA seemed totally reachable. In my eyes, they were capable of magic, while I, incapable of handling rejection, never dared ask if I could play. Then one day, Calfani shouted, "We short a man." With only 9 players, the 5-on-5 game would become 4-on-4, and one boy would have to sit out. The boys were already arguing who would take the bench. "Hey, you," Calfani waved in my direction. "You want to play?" I glanced around. He was talking to me, the quintessential onlooker. After taking a deep breath, I jogged onto the court, little bursts of nausea rising with each footfall. I even stumbled, but the boys were too busy getting hyped up for the game to notice. This was a little like being invited to dance when you have no idea where to place your feet. But things began to roll. The opposing offense loosened his shoulders, called check, and threw it to his defender. The defender passed back. The game began. Almost immediately, I was winded and struggled to keep up. But after a few minutes, something in my body clicked on, while something in my mind clicked off. I stopped thinking about how I played and started to play. Calfani launched a chest pass to me, and I staggered backward a bit. But somehow I managed to hang on to the ball. While the other boys chuckled, Calfani flashed over to the hoop with his right arm raised high in the air, screaming, "I'm open, I'm open." Breathless but wired, I passed him the ball. He drove in for a layup. And just like that, I had my first ever assist. After that day, Calfani took me under his wing. It never occurred to me back then to ask him why me, and unfortunately, I would never get that chance. We would meet up before the other boys to go to the court and take turns shooting or rebounding for each other. He made shooting the ball from the three-point line look effortless. I would put everything into trying to get the ball to the net, throwing it up with both hands, only for the ball to ricochet off the basket, rattling the entire post. "Just keep shooting," he'd say, before passing me the ball again and again and again. "You just gotta practice." Calfani and I didn't only play ball together. We met on the corner of Wayne Avenue and Fenton Street in downtown Silver Spring to walk to school together in the mornings. Calfani would often walk with me the few blocks to my parents' office when school let out, and we hung out at each other's homes on the weekends. Well, yeah, I think that's probably a good stopping point, but I can mention, as you can see, Calfani came into my life at a point where I was really needing someone to come into my life. And actually, when I decided to write the book, I flirted around whether he would be one of the 7 Black Fathers, like a peer mentor. But I felt like the introduction was the place to put him.
And introduced you to a sport that carried you also through your early years. So I think that when I'm thinking of this book, and you take us to 2 continents, right? From Kansas, where your mom was born and where she met your dad in school, Black man, white woman, to suburban Maryland, of course, outside of Washington, where you grew up and where you now make your career. But then along the way, you're learning basketball and you're getting really good at it, and it helps you belong and thrive, including at the White House, where you actually played hoops with President Obama. And in fact, at one point, it was an emergency call, basically, for you to come join a game that they needed to play. So, stepping back a little bit, and if you had never met Calfani, that was the first linchpin, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was, in so many ways, kind of like that first presence that exposed me to something I loved, but also gave me hope and mentorship and friendship. And it starts that theme of basketball and belonging that goes throughout my whole life. As you mentioned, you know, even ending up with Barack Obama, for whom I played a lot of basketball with. And I tell one story in the book of I actually spent my first Father's Day with Barack Obama playing basketball at the White House. Michelle and I are in the car coming from church. It was a Sunday, 2011, Father's Day 2011, and he calls. I get a call from Reggie Love, his body person, and they're like, hey, you want to come play basketball? I was like, absolutely. I always have my shoes in the car. I'm ready to go. And we just have our one daughter at that time. We have four children now. And Michelle says, well, we got to go get you some shorts. So we stop at TJ Maxx, or was it TJ Maxx? And pick up some shorts, and drops me off at the White House. And I end up playing basketball 2-on-2 with him and a couple other guys. And we hang out and get lunch in the residence. And it was just a full circle moment because, you know, from meeting Calfani in fifth grade and being picked up and cared for and mentored by him, here I am, you know, 30-something years later on my first Father's Day, being fathered in a different way by the president, the leader of the free world.
I mean, a couple of thoughts on that. First, you definitely want a president to have a stress relief activity.
You know about that.
Yes, I do. Basketball is about the healthiest thing you can count on. And I was really delighted to know that you helped him on that front, as well as working in the Office of Intergovernmental? No.
Public liaison.
Yeah. But I also have to think, going back to where I think you want this book to go, but tell me if this is so. It's not just a memoir. It's also a blueprint of how lives can be changed.
Absolutely.
And poor Calafani did not have that opportunity.
Right.
He died too young. If he hadn't died, we don't know what would have happened. He might have had a chance. So it's a very personal book, obviously, what you've written. And there is joy, sorrow, gratitude, love, and hope in this book. So let's talk a little bit about each of these men who helped usher this in. And then I also want to cover the women in your life.
Absolutely.
Who really were like the rudder in some ways, right? And Michelle, you're much more beautiful than a regular rudder, I will say. So there's seven gentlemen, and we've talked about President Obama. We talked about your dad, and we'll talk a little bit more about him as he ends his time here on Earth, of course. Tell me about your stepfather, Joseph Jacob.
So Joseph, I meet when I'm 7 years old. My parents have split. My mom's taken a new job at a newsletter publishing company. And I should mention, you know, you'll read this, hopefully everyone will read the book, but in the introduction, I tee up this study done by Roz Shetty at Harvard and Stanford that basically shows, it's on race and economics opportunity. And it shows that black boys and white boys born from the same area to the same background, using census and IRS data, looking at what they actually made, have wide earnings gaps, even though they came from the same background, right? So that's true in 99% of the country. There's these 1% zip codes in the country where that's not true, where black boys and white boys from the same background do what we would all hope would happen, are doing similarly well, earnings-wise, 40 years later. And it looked at the 20 million children born in the United States between 1978 and 1983. I'm in that group. And one of the distinguishing characteristics of these 1% zip codes, which I grew up adjacent to and my mother worked in, 20910 in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland, is that they had a higher percentage of working class black fathers in them. And not necessarily the fathers of the children themselves, but these fathers. And I grew up in that zip code going to my mom's job every day and met four of the seven black fathers in that zip code. Joseph is the first. I meet him when my mom takes this job. And he comes at a time where I am desperate. I mentioned the lack of relationship with my biological father, and then they get divorced, which makes it even more permanent for me. And I go from seeing him every day to seeing him every couple weeks and still not talking. Joseph is the opposite. He is present. He is engaged. It's almost overwhelming. How was your day? What are you doing? Let's go get something to eat. Let me do this. And it's at a time when I'm really desperate for that. But it's also a little off-putting because I've never experienced it. And, you know, Joseph has a high school education. He was a printer at this newsletter publishing company. But he was his love was very practical and day-to-day. And that was, and he taught me a lot of what I would call like life skills. You know, taught me how to change the oil of a car. You know, he taught me how to chop wood. You know, he taught me how to ride a motorcycle. You know, things that, you know, things I still do to this day, except for change oil on car, because there's all electronic and you can't change an oil on a car anymore. But he was very present, and he loved my mother in a deep, engaged way, which is something I hadn't observed, which was first off-putting to me because I still wanted my biological parents to be together. And I talk about that in the book. But, you know, Joseph, and he still is this way. His way of showing love is by, like, doing things and being there and being engaged. And, you know, he's my father. And I think he's the first man to step in. And one of the things you mentioned this about Kalfani, the premise of this book, obviously, one of the main through lines is that these relationships, particularly for black men and boys, can change and save lives. And Kalfani didn't have them. And I believe if he did, he would be here.
And if your mom had not met Joseph Jacob, things could have been very different too. Now let's move on to your math teacher, Mr. Williams. And his first name was?
His first name is Charles. He went by Chuck. Charles Chuck Williams, who is my fourth grade math teacher, and he's the chapter two, the only black male teacher I would ever have, as I mentioned. And I found out in researching the book, his first career is he was a Vietnam helicopter pilot and retired as a captain in the Army. You don't know this because it's not in the book. And he ended up, as his second career when he retired, becoming an elementary math teacher. And I meet him in the early 90s, as I mentioned, dealing with bullying. I'm this chubby kid. And he is just almost a superhero to me at that time. Whereas Joseph was like, you know, very daily in presence. I see this guy in a suit and he looks sharp and he's...
With a tie.
Yeah, with a tie that I had never seen, anyone, let alone a black man look like me, wear a shirt and tie every day. And he came in every day, clean as a bill of health. And it just modeled excellence for me. And he was very supportive of the classroom community. He helped us work together to solve problems. And it's one of the things that him and Joseph are great to be next to each other, because I know Joseph my entire life. I still know him. He's my dad. My stepdad. I've known him 30 plus years. I know Mr. Williams for 9 months. And I mentioned this in the book, there's research that when a student of color, particularly a black male student, has a teacher who looks like them in the elementary years, they have much higher student achievement later in their career. Now, black male teachers only comprise 2% of the teaching workforce. So one of the things as a call to action in this book is to enable more of these relationships. One strategy to do that is to hire more black teachers, to create a pipeline, to recruit and pay and train and retain. But Mr. Williams comes at a key time. He's the first person I ever see code switch, which is a term of art where he's very professional and proper in the classroom. But I see him talking to a janitor after school one day, an African-American guy, and they're like kind of shooting a breeze and they're using slang. And he was teaching me that it was okay to be more than one thing, to be relaxed and to embrace your culture. And so he just had a transformational impact on me at a time that was really important.
Gave you your first tie, right?
Gave me my first tie, taught me how to tie it. I'm not wearing one today, but in my day job, I wear ties often. And I smile in the mirror when I'm tying my Windsor knot. I think about Mr. Williams quite often.
Jay Fletcher.
Yeah, Jay is a reporter at my mom's job at this newsletter publishing company and someone after your own heart. And he is the first openly gay black man I ever meet. And again, I can't underscore enough the fact that I was able to go to this office every day and meet these men and just wander around. That I was in this zip code where there were more of these men. And then I was at this job where my mom's CEO let me wander around. But Jay, I encountered just kind of wandering around after school in the office, popping heads in cubicles. And he takes a very intentional interest in me. At the time, I'm eating McDonald's like every day after school. I'm a chubby kid. I had high blood pressure at, you know, like 10. And
another widespread problem. I mean, a real problem.
Oh, huge.
In minority communities.
Yeah, healthy eating. You know, when I worked on Let's Move with Michelle Obama and the child nutrition reauthorization, it's a huge issue. So Jay is the first one who kind of challenges that for me. And, you know, teaches me how to eat healthy and talks to me about the value of it. I remember he took me to his house one day and he was making dinner and he pulls out a steamer and he's steaming some vegetables like spinach and broccoli. And I'm like, what is that? I've never seen it. It's like, what's that metal thing and what are those things inside of it? And he explains it to me. And spinach is like one of my favorite things to this day. He exposes me to the arts in a very intentional way. He takes me to my first Broadway play to see Seven Guitars, and August Wilson play, which is an awesome play, by the way, and starring Viola Davis. He teaches me how to play backgammon and chess and Risk and gives me a lot of things.
This was a whole separate education.
Oh, a whole separate education. Teaches me how to play tennis, you know, just things. And I think one of the things about all these men, they expose me to different things and they teach me different things.
So where do we find people like that to help young black boys and girls?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. They exist. One of the things I try to underscore here is that we are the treasure of our own communities. We're here. And I think one of the things that happens, unfortunately, is we complicate it and we think that it has to be through a formal program. Or it has to be for a longer period of time. All these relationships are different in duration and what I was taught and how long I knew them and who the men were. But they all helped me are helping me on my journey to wholeness. This is my seven black fathers, a story of the mentors who made me whole. I meet Mr. Williams in fourth grade. I meet President Obama when I'm 24. They all gave me different things that I needed and still need. And I think one of the call to actions from the book is that these men are present. We just need to engage more, enable these through policy. If you're a superintendent, form a program to hire and train more black male teachers. Make sure there's after-school programs at all your schools. There's a lot of things you can do from multiple angles. If you're a black man or boy, have these relationships. Be open to having them. Mentorship's a two-way street. You can't do it one way. So I think there's that we have what we need in the community right now to do it.
And you talk a little bit about My Brother's Keeper.
Yes.
In the book. And also there are organizations like Boys and Girls Clubs.
Absolutely.
As well. And still a crying need for more.
Well, I think what we're seeing in Chicago, what we're seeing in Baltimore, what we're seeing in, you know, in much of the country, and this isn't to say that this is a cure-all for the systemic inequities that lead to the problems we face. Like, for example, the New York Times a few years ago wrote an article about there's 1 million black men missing because of mass incarceration from communities. That matters, right? It lowers the likelihood for these relationships to happen. So but there are many of us. I think this is something that we can do in the midst of the storm that we're in to affirmatively change lives. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be one way. It doesn't have to be one thing that you give. And as I said, this book, I demonstrate through my life, through each of these very different men, what they gave me.
So moving on our list, Coach Holmes.
Coach Holmes, Coach Wayne Holmes. So Wayne Holmes is a 6'6", Penn State All-American offensive lineman who hurt his back and then comes back to teach at the high school that I went to, St. John's College High School. And I meet him in high school, and he starts an informal gospel choir that I kind of walk by and hear the people singing, and he invites me in, and I end up joining the choir. And Wayne is just an awesome person. He helps me, one, learn how to be multiple things, right? Like I can be an athlete and a singer I can, he helps me through devastating disappointment in my athletic career. He takes me, he drives me to college. When I come back from college, from North Carolina Central, where I had a scholarship, but the coach redshirted me and didn't want me to play, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I live with Wayne for a year, and I joined the AmeriCorps program. And Wayne was just, he trained me in high school in the weight room and helped me push past my physical limits that were really mental limits. And so Wayne gives me some very unique things. He also helps me to explore my faith in a way. I tell my faith journey in this book, and Wayne is there for me in that way. And so, expressed through the gospel choir, but also just through our interpersonal connection. And, you know, again, I meet Wayne in high school, where I'm this captain of the basketball team, and an unlikely person for him to join his choir, which is made up. I talk about it in the book as the truly first inclusive group I was ever in. It had, you know, all types of different people in it, sexuality-wise, you know, types of kids, you know, and Wayne created that welcoming space for me at a time when I needed to learn about that.
These are all fascinating men on their own, I gotta say. But the one where it was like the Wizard of Oz or WandaVision, where it goes from black and white to color, glorious color, is Dean
Samwuya.
Samwuya.
Yeah. Okay. So Dean, another one of these all-stars at my mom's job, so I meet him. He's the IT systems guy at the job, and he's Nigerian, and again, I'm wandering around this place and I meet him. He comes a little later than Jay. He's not there when I meet Jay. He comes a few years later. And I had been longing for a connection to my Nigerian heritage, right? You know, and all of us, no matter where we come from, we want to know our roots and know where our parents and our grandparents and others come from. And it was one of my major frustration points with my dad that I felt he didn't expose me and teach me enough about that part of my culture. You know, when he came here, he's dealing with all that significant racism and depression. So he doesn't go back to Nigeria for more than 30 years. I tell the story of my grandmother, my dad's mother, who passes away when I'm in high school. And because she's Muslim, they had to bury her within a certain number of hours. And we don't get to the funeral. And it's just, I'm very upset about it. And Dean ends up taking me to Nigeria for the first time when I'm 19 years old. And I go and he's a bi-continent businessman. He's an IT person, but he's also an entrepreneur.
You talk about Nigerian hustle.
Yes, Nigerian hustle. Dean models for me tenacity, hustle, just never giving up. You know, I tell the story of a book. He would fill trucks of goods and services and ship them over to Nigeria and then give them out like it was like he was Santa Claus. And I never knew how he did it, but I knew he was meeting a need, and he was just tenacious. He was always moving. He had two phones before it was common to have two phones, you know, and I would just always watch him. And that's something that has stuck with me, learning how to just grind it out and to hustle. And maybe the most direct thing Dean gave me, he started me, and he didn't know he was doing this, which is often the case with mentorship. He started me on the path for healing and forgiveness with my father by taking me to Nigeria. And 2 years later, I would take a transformational trip with Michelle and my dad to Nigeria. When I went with Dean, everyone would ask me, well, where's your dad? You know, why is he not here? You know, all the family members. And so that put some pressure on my dad to go to Nigeria. So 2 years later, we have a trip that really starts the reconciliation process with my dad to Nigeria. But it wouldn't have happened if Dean wouldn't have bought me that ticket to Nigeria.
Well, a lot happened on that trip, didn't it?
Yes. Yes,
okay,
quite a bit.
So you have to tell the story. Or read the expert review, but tell the story about you go to a wedding and then on the trip back, what happens and what Dean does.
So when I go to Nigeria, and if anyone who's ever been to, you know, sub-Saharan Africa or any, you know, there's other places like it, it's as soon as you get off the plane, it's like you just feel like anything could happen. You know, like you can just smell it in the air. And so I go to Nigeria, and Dean grew up in Ikorodu, which is out of southwest Nigeria. It's a little outside, part of Lagos, which is the former capital. And it's a very working class area. And so there's a lot happening. And we go to a wedding, and you know, if there's nothing like a Nigerian wedding. It's kind of like Indian weddings. Like those are like, you know, it's like those are the weddings you want to crash. And so we go to a wedding, and we're driving, and we had a great time. It was, you know, it was fun. And we're coming back, and Dean's not with us. He had to do something else. And we get pulled over by the military police, who put shotguns and, you know, AK-47s right at the window.
And this was not unusual, right?
No, not unusual at all. There's, you know, corruption is a huge issue in Nigeria and many countries, and there were a lot of police presence and military police. And there's four of us in the car, and we get stopped, and there's one of our guys is a French national. He's Nigerian, but a French citizen. And or he's from Cameroon, actually. And he was along from the wedding, and they start pulling us over. And mostly what they do when they pull you over is they want a bribe. They want you to give them some money so you move on. And, you know, I don't know any of this at the time, but I realized after. And they start going through the car, and this guy has insulin in the car and you know, needles.
This is the French.
The French gentleman. And they take it out, and they're like, this is drug paraphernalia, right? And they throw it on the ground, and they break it up, you know, so now he's in danger of not having his insulin. And they take him, they haul him off, they throw him into the car and take him to jail, to the prison. And we barely get out of there. You know, there's some argument, and somehow we get to go. And we go home, and I get to Dean, and he's, like, furious. So he goes into his room. He goes into a safe in his room, and he gets out these...
In the floor. And the safe was in the floor.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing a movie here, really. This is just... It's incredibly, really colorful. Go on.
Yes. It was in the floor. He does the combination, pulls up the panels, and then takes out these stacks, and then goes and gives it to his you know, his kind of one of his close friends. And they go, and he and this other guy go, and they come back hours later with the French national. And, you know, Dean's a little bruised, and it was...
But part of this, too, though, is your name is not unknown in Nigeria.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that should have mentioned.
Your name is very well known, and your uncle headed the development agency for a long time.
Yeah, my uncle in southwest Nigeria, Jawando is known. It's also a unique name. It's not a common Nigerian name. And my uncle, my dad's older brother, who's 80 now, designed much of the kind of more exclusive parts of Nigeria, Lekki and Victoria Island areas. And so it's known to when we get out of this mess, you know, it's my uncle's name is dropped, you know, to help us get out of this. And it just was a learning experience, but also just a testament to Dean just got stuff done, you know.
Well, it was really chilling to read it in the book, especially wondering if the diabetic was going to get his insulin on time.
Or if he was going to live.
It's potentially fatal. Yeah,
absolutely.
Fatal if you don't have it.
Absolutely.
So having undergone all of this as an introduction to Nigeria, you go back years later.
Yes.
And Michelle goes with you.
Yeah, we go back. It would be the only trip my dad takes back before he dies in 2005. And I tell Michelle to come with me, or I ask her, and she agrees. And we visit where he grew up in Ibadan, which is like 2 hours north of Lagos. and we go to the family home, and my grandparents are buried there in the backyard. And it's a huge home, but it has now been in disrepair for years, yeah. And there are multiple tenants living, you know, kind of in the home, and it's very disheartening to my father.
Although they're respectful.
Oh, very respectful. Very respectful. They were kind, but it wasn't the place, you know,
yeah.
that he had left.
Of course.
And so it's just a very emotional trip. You know, he hadn't been back in 30 years. We go, and, you know, I tell this story of in the book of, you know, I'm learning about him. I'm understanding, you know, more about him, why he was the way he was, the disappointments in his life. And it's creating a deeper empathy and giving me the ability, which all of these men do, to ultimately forgive him. But this is really the first moment where I'm able to kind of put aside the anger for the lack of his presence and almost come out of body and be empathetic to him and understand what he was going through. And we sit at the grave of my grandparents, because, you know, seeing my grandmother's grave was hard for me because I wanted to be there. And that was a source of real anger for me when she passed away. And
we should note that the family ties are so deep that when you and your dad came to visit, one of your relatives, his sister, took a bus 14 hours or 15
yes.
hours to come see him after 30 years
yes.
of not having seen him. And you were greeted like the long-lost family that you all were.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are very deep and emotional ties there.
Absolutely. And I one of the things I realized is my dad always had those in his own way. You know, he felt that familial. I think it was that guilt of his and lack of success that kept him from going in a lot of ways, going back. But yeah, my aunt came from Kaduna, which is in the north, took that 14-hour bus ride down. And so we have this really emotional reconciliation at my grandparents' grave where we're both crying, you know, just about being there and what it meant and the state of the house and just a lot of a flood of emotions. You know, there was a river behind the house that he used to play in as a child, which was now and was basically a trash dump, you know. And so it was also his first time back, like, you know, seeing the country and the state it's in, right? And so that was tough too. So I think I understood him more deeply. We got to share that connective moment. And that was really, it wasn't like things were good overnight, but it was the starting point to us really reconciling and getting on a good path.
And then there seems to be a turning point, right? Where he's introduced to Carolyn. Great name, by the way.
Yes.
And there's some magic there. It looks like there's a real match. But then what happens?
Well, one of the big unfortunate things about my dad and, you know, is that, you know, he never remarries. And he's alone, at least in that kind of romantic way. He has a really good relationship with Carolyn, and who is Senator Obama's office manager. I actually connect them when I'm working for Senator Obama, and they have a good relationship, but they don't get married. And I think he just doesn't know how to recommit. He's got too many disappointments. I don't know the psychology of it, but he never lets himself love again in that way. And unfortunately, they separate. And a year after that, he gets cancer. But thankfully, we're in a position to take him in. And he comes and lives with us, and has four and a half more good years and is able to have a real impact with his grandchildren. But yeah, it was one of those things where I wished he had allowed himself to love again.
And maybe even had cancer treatment, which he refused.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he waited. I'm a big advocate for, it's prostate cancer. He gets it, doesn't go to the doctor, doesn't get it, follow the advice, and then he waits a year, tries to treat it on his own, and it spreads. And it's a horrible disease.
But the feeling, as I was reading it, was one of great reconciliation, a familial reconciliation.
Oh, absolutely.
And some real peace. So, and before we run out of time, and I'm watching the clock up there, a really beautiful clock. And isn't this a gorgeous room, by the way?
Oh, it's great.
So I want to talk about the women. You mentioned wanting to meet your grandmother, and you didn't have that opportunity, but you saw a lot of family when you were there. But then it came time for you to start thinking about your own family, and you have one of the best meet cutes I've ever read about in a memoir. Tell us how you and Michelle met.
So Michelle and I met at a Chichon Lounge in D.C., if you've ever been in Washington, D.C. It's a great place and on U Street. And I get up. We're both there because there's a mutual friend that's having a going-away party. And we're there. And I'm sitting down at it's like a lounge, sitting in chairs like this, and there's a table like this. And I'm talking to some ladies that are around. And I get up and go to the bathroom, and I come back, and Michelle's sitting in my seat.
Michelle.
Yeah. She's claimed her feet were hurting.
She says she had high heels on. I get it.
And I said, hey, you're in my seat. She said, well, you know, I'm not going to move, but we can share. Kind of bats her eyes. And so we have this long conversation, very D.C. conversation. I'm going to change the world. I'm going to run for office. I'm going to do this. And then we talk for a long time. And 9 months later, we're engaged. But she took my seat. So I think it was intentional. She targeted me. And it worked out, though. It worked out. But to your point of the women, maybe you're going to go there, but Michelle is a critical component of the relationship with my dad, of almost mediating. And, you know, when he's dying of cancer, we set up hospice in our house. When he needs 24-hour care, you know, she's right there just like I am. She was on this trip with us, and she helped both of us because, you know, when you're reconciling, it's not like it's all great. It's not like, oh, we don't like each other and now we do again. There's a process. And we had a lot of bumps in that process, and she was there to help us navigate it. And my mother, you know, is another prominent woman in this book who was just my rock, my constant, you know.
Insisting on it, the best education, even when it was hard to afford.
Absolutely. One of the systemic factors I talk about, I go to 5 schools before I'm in 8th grade because I was one of the many black children that was suggested to go on Ritalin and was, you know, evaluated for special education at higher rates. And my mother wouldn't let it happen, and she kept moving me. And at great personal expense, you know, she paid for me to go to Catholic school. I went for public for a time. And she just advocated for me relentlessly. And the thing that I just, looking back and writing this book, the bravery and the recognizing that I needed something that she couldn't give me, and then allowing me to get it, right? You know, like allowing me to have these relationships with these men and enabling them was really a model for what I hope will come out of this book, that we will all see it as our job to enable and have these relationships that are life-saving.
You may be in a position to make that happen. And I don't know that you've even had a chance to read the book yet, but it's about the importance of taking young people, especially those at risk, under your wing, because when you do, absolutely fabulous things can happen. And, it's much needed. And good luck to you as you continue. I'm looking for the sequel. And I want pictures inside next time. Family pictures, friend pictures, lots of pictures. Pictures of Nigeria.
Got it.
Because it sounds pretty amazing.
Second edition.
And thank you so much, Will Juwondo.
Thank you.
This has really been terrific.
Thank you.
Audience, thank you so much for being here. And for supporting the AWM.
Thank you all again.
Wonderful book. Congratulations.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Dr. Clarence Lussain discusses his book, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.